I think I can start. Is it loud enough?
Sure.
Okay, I will adjust my voice. So the question which I want to discuss today is the following. Are there any four-dimensional conformal field theories with scalars? That's the question which I will try to discuss today. And I will discuss this
question. Only with scalars?
Well, no. Like gauge fields, spinners, and scalars.
So what about N equal 4?
Well, it should be non-supersymmetric field theory.
Oh, non-supersymmetric.
Right.
Okay.
So, and I will discuss this question in the context of N equal 4 super Young mills, actually in the context of orbifold N equal 4 Young mills. So let me start with that. I have N equal 4 super Young mills, and I want to consider orbifold and ask a question whether it is conformal. But before I go on, let me give you a plan of my talk. As a first point, I would like to present my motivation, why I generally think this theory could be conformal. I will discuss both cases. As a second point, I will discuss a strong coupling regime. And the main tool here is the ADS gravity dual solution. This part of my talk will be mainly based on the work by Adams and Silverstein. And the third one, which will be based on the work which was done by Igor Klebanov, Rad Roiban, and me, will discuss the weak coupling behavior. The last part will be conclusive part. Conclusion. Okay, I think I'm ready to start talking about physics. So my motivation is the following. If I consider, let me start from the ADS point of view. If I have louder? Even louder. Okay, or just get higher. If I have
not taller.
Okay. I'm tall enough. If I have an ADS gravity dual solution, so I have ADS 5 cross something here, and this something is probably a sphere divided by orbifold group. So this is an orbifold group, which will be Zn in the rest of my talk. Then I immediately conclude that the dual quantum field theory is conformal because ADS 5 possesses SO 4,2 group symmetry as a geometrical symmetry. So my theory has to be conformal. That's the first clue why orbifold should be conformal. But this approximation is valid only at strong coupling. That's the reason. That was the reason why strong coupling, my orbifold has to be conformal. And there is also a reason why it has to be conformal at weak coupling. This argument is based on the work by Bershadsky and Johansson, and it's called the inheritance principle. Or we can say perturbative inheritance principle. It says that any planar diagram in orbifold field theory is related to the planar diagram in the underlying parent theory with some redefinition of the coupling constant. So let me write it here. Equal to blah, blah, blah in the parent theory.
Excuse me? Do you have any assumption on how gamma axons
are? Not yet, but I will talk later. I will consider two different cases. There are two different cases when gamma preserves some point, which is fixed point, and there and the case where there are no fixed points at all. Yeah, so I will discuss two cases independently. So far, this is not rigorous heuristic arguments, just the motivation. And then I will add details and explain why this logic is not 100% correct.
This inheritance principle. So you say you may need to redefine the coupling constant?
Right. So
for all diagrams uniformly or diagram by diagram?
For all diagrams uniformly.
Okay.
So the result for the planar diagram... Planar is not the good word. I will clarify, but so far it's okay that, to say that it is planar. Any planar diagram in Arbifold field theory, which depends on coupling constant lambda, it's called coupling constant, is equal to the parent theory diagram. Well, here we have lambda, and here we should have lambda divided by gamma. This is an order of Arbifold group. But if we have zero result in parent theory, we must have the same zero result in the Arbifold theory, right? Because zero comes to zero.
This is also true for turbo, right?
Right. It is true diagram by diagram, so order by order. So we can say that it is true non-perturbatively as well.
Well, there are arguments for which this equivalence is actually not true.
The flow here is the word planar. It's not really planar. There is also a condition that the planar diagram has to have only one external boundary. Let me talk later about that. That's a detail. So if we have diagrams which correspond to beta function for this coupling constant lambda, and it is definitely zero and in n equal 4, then it has to be zero for a scaled coupling constant in the Arbifold theory. And that is why I immediately imply that the coupling constant doesn't run and the theory is CFT. So that was my reasoning for weak coupling regime.
But that's only for large n limit.
Yes, that's only for large n limit. But I don't have any reasoning for finite n limit. So for the rest of my talk, I will focus on large n. Okay, I am done with first step. Can I just erase that? That was my motivation, and now I start discussing ADS in more details. First of all, if I want the ADS approximation to be reliable, I must say that the radius of ADS should be very strong. So lambda is large. That's the first constraint. And the second constraint, my gravity solution should be stable. So I should say that there is no tachyon. And as Sergei pointed out, we have two different cases here. We have a case when S5 divided by Zn has fixed point, so we have an Arbifold with fixed point. So we have with and without fixed point. So two cases. Let's discuss this case first. Adams and Silverstein investigated this case, and they shown that there is always a tachyon in the twisted sector of the superstring, of the closed superstring. So we have a sphere. This is a fixed point. I can start my closed string and finish it at the same point. I can imagine a superstring which is very small. If it is very small, the classical energy goes to zero, but there are quantum fluctuations which are negative, as you know, and we have a tachyon. If we have a tachyon, the gravity background is not stable, and we cannot believe this approximation anymore. So what does it mean from the field theory point of view? Adams and Silverstein studied several several particular examples in the Wigg-Kaplan regime, and they calculated one loop Coleman-Weinberg potential, so mainly one loop effective action on a ground field, and it is not zero. So at one loop we have some double trace operator generated, and after that we can discuss the dynamics of this new potential, and they demonstrated that the scalar field phi gets non-trivial vacuum expectation value. And this is the Kern condensation. And of course, if phi has non-trivial vacuum expectation value, the theory is not conformal anymore. So I will reserve this part for the table of results. I have a fixed point. And there is no fixed point. And this will be strong coupling. And at strong coupling, this is not a CFT due to tachyon. And they also shown that this is not a CFT at weak coupling as well, because they calculated one loop. But they did that for certain examples. We generalized this approach, and we found that, I will talk about that a little bit later, that if we consider an Erbe-fold with fixed point, arbitrary Erbe-fold, there is always a Coleman-Weinberg potential, and it is not a CFT at Wigg-Kaplan as well. Okay. Now let me switch to the case when I don't have fixed points. Say I have a point A, and the action of gamma turns it, this is an action of group gamma, I must identify this point A and this point A prime, and here my closed string, since this point and this point are identical, this is my closed string in the twisted sector, and the length of this string is of order R. R is the radius. And R goes to infinity, so classically my string is very heavy, and therefore there is no tachyon, because tachyon is the only certain finite negative subtraction from the energy. And if there is no tachyon, this means that my gravity background is stable, and I can believe this approximation. I have geometrical symmetries of ADS, and I conclude that my theory is conformal. Well, here I finish my part devoted to ADS and turn to the Kaplan consideration.
One question.
Yeah.
You mentioned something about double trace.
Right.
How would they appear?
I will just explain how they appear, because double traces, this is a part of the Wigg-Kaplan story, because we cannot control anything at strong coupling using perturbative calculations. But at Wigg-Kaplan, we can calculate one loop or two loops as far as we can. Coleman-Weinberg potential, which is actually effective action on the background field. And we will find that double trace operators are generated, and there is no way we can renormalize them to zero. So if there is a coupling which runs, as far as we calculate loops, we conclude that the theory is not conformal. Okay?
But how is this S5 version of the DNR before defined from the usual one gives the supersymmetric and plus 2 CFT?
Okay. Let me clarify. You mean what's the difference between Erbe-fold which preserves several supersymmetries? Are you asking about Erbe-fold with fixed point or without fixed point?
That doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter.
The question is what choice of gamma gives supersymmetry and which one doesn't.
Oh, you mean just how to understand, if I give you gamma, how to understand how many supersymmetries are preserved? I will answer in a second, okay? I thought you asked about physical. What's the different mechanism? Why we have CFT in one case and we don't have CFT in another case? I have only technical argument for this question. So I would like to speak about perturbative calculations. So first of all, I need to introduce some notations, and I will explain how I define my orbifold. I have gamma, which is the n for our consideration. I embed this gamma into gauge group. I have n equal 4, and I will assume that this n equal 4 has gauge group SUN and large. It will be more convenient for me because then I will split this group to SU, well, to UN to the power N divided by U1. And my lambda, coupling constant, will be G squared over N. Okay, so I embed this group into gauge group. I have G, which is an element of ZN, and G will be an element of SU and small and large. And I also embed this group into SU4. And the origin of SU4 is very simple. The spectrum of super young mills is scalar fields, phi's, which are 6 of SO6, gauge fields, and spinner fields, psi I. And these are 4 of SU4. So first of all, I want to define how my orbifold acts on psi's, and it acts by matrix R. And then I embed this into R, which rotates phi's. I can diagonalize my matrix R. Well, Zn is very simple, right? I have one generator and then the powers of this generator. So it is enough if I want to set up a representation, it is enough to say how I will represent my generator. And the general representation is the following. It is a 4 by 4 matrix, which is diagonal, and it has En1 alpha. It has four numbers on the diagonal. The sum of these numbers is equal to 0 modulus n, and alpha is equal to 2 pi divided by n. So that's the most general definition of the orbifold, Zn orbifold. Then my six-dimensional space of phi's will also split in a direct sum of irreducible representations of Zn, and I will have the following weights. It will be plus minus E alpha and I plus NJ. Well, that's two different I's here. And I non-equal to J, and IJ runs from 1 to 4. Well, I will write in a moment what I have here. So I have six weights. This is R. Okay. One more thing.
1, 2, 1, 3, 2, 3.
Here it runs from 1 to 4.
No, but if you plus or minus, you're
completely. Oh, right. It should be only plus here. Sorry. Yeah, it's the same. Okay, one more thing. I must say a few words about this representation. I cannot consider any arbitrary representation. It should be so-called regular. Regular representation, by definition, is that one. If I have a trace of gamma 1, gamma 2 dagger, which is a trace gamma J1, gamma of J2 dagger, minus first, then it is non-zero if and only if J1 is equal to J2. The origin of this restriction is the following. The Bershadsky-Johansson theorem, inheritance theorem, will not work if I don't have this property of the representation. So if I want to have any reason for my theory to be conformal, I must have this condition, external constraint. So is regular. And usually what we usually do, we just consider gamma as a matrix of the following form. Oh well. It's not enough space here. I will write gamma instead of this matrix.
So now you're doing the representation in the gauge group.
Right, right. And I usually use only one of it because it should be regular. And this is enlarged diagonal matrices, diagonal blocks. And here I have one, here I have E alpha, here I have 2 E alpha, and so on. And here I have E alpha N minus 1. So one can check that this is a regular representation. Namely, trace gamma to the K is not equal to 0 only if K equal to 0. Okay, here I finish the definition. That's all what I want to say about how I define my orbifold theory. And now I turn to loop calculations. Well, any questions at this point? Okay. So I have an action. Actually, I don't want to write down the full action. I will write down only the three-level potential. Three-level potential is the following: lambda over n, raise phi I phi j, phi I phi j, and that's all. That's a three-level action. If I start calculating the loops, I will have the diagram of this kind. And generally, I can get one loop Coleman-Weinberg potential. So generally, I can have two different operators here: one trace operator and double trace operators. When I write something like here, like that, first of all, I mean that I contract Lorentz indexes in all possible ways, and second, generally, non-twisted operators will not appear. So I always assume that they have gamma and gamma dagger here, and I sum over all possible gammas with all possible coefficients. So a coefficient here and so on. But I will skip all these details if I don't.
Is it non-twisted operators don't appear or twisted operators don't appear?
Non-twisted operators don't appear because non-twisted sector is just inherited from n equal 4.
So what do you mean exactly by this? So what's your notation here? If it's not inherited?
Let me write the explicit formula. I have sum over all j, which is an element of Gn. Here I have some coefficient, and here I have trace gamma phi I phi j trace gamma dagger j. This is an opposite element, inverse element. 1, 2, phi j 2. And I contract well, this is most general Lorentz invariant object, so this is deltas. Mainly, I can have phi squared, and I can have phi I, phi j, phi I. That's all what I can have. And this guy can appear, and it does appears. When I say that non-twisted operators don't appear, I mean that fg equal 1, I mean like matrix 1, is equal to 0, always. According to inheritance theorem, this operator will not appear because it is non-twisted. And let me tell you more details about this inheritance theorem and how it is exactly formulated. So this is a result by Bereshetsky and Johansson. Yes.
A very stupid question, but why is it okay to take gamma acting within the gauge group?
Why is it okay?
Yeah.
Oh, well, first of all, I didn't say how I project my states in my theory. Only those states survive which phi I, which are invariant under the projection, and the projection is defined in this way. Gamma J or J A J gamma J. So I combine the geometrical action on the sphere with the gauge action. And that is why these gammas appear. Actually, I don't have any R's here, right? I don't have any R's. I said that this is just a delta function, Lorentz invariant object, and these gammas are a price for that. I can remove these gammas, but introduce R's large here. Because I can rotate everything in a gauge, so in a gauge space, but then I have to add some R's large in front. But I prefer to keep gammas. So this theorem says that any planar diagram which has only one external boundary, so the diagram like that, is indeed inheritance from the parent theory. But the diagram which has two internal, which has two external boundaries is not inherited. Let me draw it first. It's not that easy. Okay. So this diagram is inherited. This is not. To understand what's the difference, I will not prove this theorem, but let me just explain the general idea. Let me first simplify the consideration and say that the geometrical action on S5 is always trivial. So R is just a unit matrix. So what I have then, I have only gauge twist. In this case, if I have a closed loop inside, here I have gamma 1, here again gamma 2 dagger. I remember that my representation is a regular representation. Here I have a trace, since I have a closed loop. You remember that I required before that my representation is regular. That is why I conclude that gamma 1 is equal to gamma 2. Okay, so gamma 1 dagger gamma 1. And therefore, if I have only one boundary, these two gammas annihilate each other. And therefore, I have the result from the n equal 4 theory. But if I have two different edges, excuse me, two different boundaries, I have gamma 1, gamma 2, and gamma 1 dagger, gamma 2 dagger. And instead of having this nice constellation and nice delta function, I will have something like that. Trace gamma 1, gamma 2 dagger phi squared, and trace gamma 2, gamma 1 dagger phi squared. And there is no way to simplify this expression. And this is the expression for this diagram, and here I have trace gamma 1, gamma 2 dagger, trace gamma 2, gamma 1 dagger phi to the fourth. So that's the technical difference. And here I can eliminate this guy and eliminate this guy, but here I cannot simplify it. I just can say that this is gamma and this is gamma dagger and get exactly this result. So this is a technical difference, but we cannot avoid it. I mean that this...
This is the string argument, actually. This came from strings, this argument that you described.
It appears on... Right. It was first found on the when people calculated string amplitudes.
No, I mean the argument you're giving was originally formulated in string theory, but that infinite theory was difficult to imagine. And then once we found the argument at the simple level, then you translate the infinite theory diagram, which is
right.
So the argument is very simple. It's just geometric fact that you, when you sum over open diagrams, you sum over all holonomies.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have any holonomies which has no operator inserted, you just get trace count as zero because of the regular representation. So it's a very simple proof.
Okay. Okay, so we indeed see that these operators will appear, and what the best thing we can do, we can try to introduce the same operators on the tree level, right, and start renormalization procedure. And if we are lucky, we will be able to find such tree level and one loop values for the couplings which vanish beta function. In other words, the best thing we can do, we can try to look for the fixed line in a space of couplings. Well, that's the most important idea here. So these guys indeed appear, and the best thing we can do, we can try to look for the fixed line in the space of couplings.
When will you answer the question about supersymmetry?
Right now.
Okay.
How many time I already spent? How much? Huh? Half an hour. Oh, okay. I have enough time to answer the question. So once again, I described delta S one loop. I don't have single trace. This is zero. I just want to emphasize that I don't have this guy, and I have these guys. And let me explain in details what's the structure of one loop beta function for these operators. So I introduce these operators on a tree level. So S3 is equal to S n equal 4 divided by gamma. Plus I introduce this operator on a tree level. And then I started renormalization. So beta f will contain the following terms. First of all, this guy, which is proportional to lambda squared. Here we have g squared, here we have g squared, and the same here. So one loop result is always proportional to lambda squared. But as far as we introduce the tree-level result, we will also have here a few more terms. First of all, we will have phi squared term. Okay? And the origin of this term is very simple. If I introduce this operator on a tree level, I will have the following diagram. This is the vertex which comes from here. Here, f is staying here. I have the same vertex here. And here it is. That's the diagram. Okay? So this is a contribution here. With some coefficients in front which I don't specify yet. But we also have a term which is linear in both coupling constants. And the corresponding diagram is also very simple. I start from the vertex with F, and then I renormalize one leg in all possible ways at one loop. And here it is. And my question is it possible to find such a fixed point that this beta is zero for all values of lambda, at least at weak coupling? Well, now I will try to answer the question. Let's consider a fixed point or default. With fixed point. Let me remind you that R is diagonal matrix which has the following weights, and I plus nj alpha, and ij runs from 1 to 3. If I have one fixed point, say n1 plus n2 is equal to 0, actually, I have the whole plane of fixed points because I have two weights equal to zero. And this is the starting point for me because now I introduce indexes which run along this fixed point space, and I introduced a special operator. First of all, it will be mu nu g, which is trace g f mu nu. And these guys are invariant, they are adjoints. I forgot to say that if field is invariant under the action of geometrical action of Zn, then it is adjoint. Is it clear? I need to explain why. If phi is equal to gamma phi gamma dagger, and gamma is block diagonal, then phi also has to be block diagonal. And this is adjoint fields. Then I introduce the new operator, OG mu nu traceless, which is OG mu nu minus 1/2 delta mu nu O rho rho. Okay. Let me return back here and notice that this some of these diagrams are nothing else as the renormalization of this operator. In other words, this is anomalous dimension of the operator, of this single trace operator. Okay? I also know from n equal 4 that the anomalous dimension for symmetric traceless operator is 0. And this statement holds for the orbifold theory as well, as far as my operator consists of adjoint fields. So delta of OJ mu nu, since it is traceless symmetric, is 0. And the beta function simplifies crucially. Actually, beta for this operator is equal to something lambda squared plus something f squared. There is no lambda f term. This is very nice because we have only two coefficients and lambda and f completely independent. The coefficient in front of f squared is equal to 1 over 16 pi squared n, and it is positive. Actually, it has to be positive because if we assume that the theory is unitary, just a few words about it. This coefficient, as we discussed before, is this diagram. So it is nothing else as the correlation function OG dagger. And this is the modulus square of OJ, which acts on vacuum state. And this guy is always positive. So I have a positive coefficient here, and I have something here. Let me return back to R. And since I have n1 equal to minus n2, I can introduce notation n prime, and it is easy to conclude that n3 has to be equal to minus n4, since the sum of all n is equal to 0. And R has the following form: e n prime alpha, e minus e n prime alpha, e I n2 prime alpha, e minus e n2 prime alpha. That's the most general orbifold with fixed point. And the coefficient here is something which I don't really remember. The positive coefficient, something like 16 pi squared over n, and sine squared n prime alpha over 2. Oh, I'm sorry, I will write again. Sine n prime alpha over 2 squared, sine n 2 prime alpha over 2 squared, divided by 16 pi squared n. And as you see, this coefficient is also non-negative, right? And unless n prime or n 2 prime is equal to 0, we cannot find any non-trivial solution for beta equal to 0. So it is positive unless n prime equal to 0 or n 2 prime is equal to 0. Well, f has to be equal to 0 always, but this is quite trivial. It just means that I don't introduce double traces at 3 level. what's the relation to supersymmetry here? The relation is simple. Let us calculate the supersymmetry preserved. In n equal 4, I have four supersymmetries, which are 4 of SU4. And those one, this is a vector QI, and those one which are preserved under the orbifold actions are those which satisfy the following equation. Rij QJ is equal to QI. Okay? So I have as many supersymmetries preserved, as many ones I have on the diagonal. If I have one, say here, this is n equal 1. If I have two ones here, this is n equal 2. So I see that since n prime or n two primes has to be equal 1, I have at least n 2, or I have n 4 if both of them are equal to 1. So if both of them are equal to 0. So this is the relation to supersymmetry. If I don't have supersymmetry, my orbifold with fixed point is always non-conformal, because this beta function doesn't possess any fixed point, any fixed line. Is that clear? Okay.
So you always have some supersymmetry.
Huh?
You always have some, at least an equal point.
No. I say that if I have only one here, then I have n1 supersymmetry. If I have two ones here, I have n2 supersymmetry. Now let me write the statement here.
In the case of fixed point, you need at least n equal 2.
Right. Well, if I... it's enough for me to have n equal 1, actually, but it is impossible to have n equal 1. It will be n equal 2. So if I have fixed points, there is no CFT at weak coupling unless I have n equal 2 supersymmetry. But I don't consider a supersymmetric case. A few words about it. Any supersymmetric theory has to be conformal because all double traces, which are F and D terms, are related to Hopf coupling constant, right? There is only one coupling constant in n equal 2 theory. And all double traces are related to it. All double traces couplings are related to it. And this coupling constant is renormalized only within single trace operators, only... because it is a coupling constant in front of trace phi to the fourth. And as a result, I can inherit it from the parent theory, and this beta function is zero, and that is why all the beta functions in theory are zeros. So in a supersymmetric case, I'm sure that the theory is conformal at any order.
That's a stupid question. Can the double trace operators contribute to the original beta function for beta lambda, or is it obvious that they cannot?
Well, if I will consider a complicated diagram, and some part of this diagram is the part which is responsible for the generating of double trace, right? That's your question. I still believe. Well,
what I'm asking is, if you look at beta lambda,
right?
Can it have pieces proportional to f?
If I introduce f at tree level?
At tree level, right.
I don't think it will. At least not at one loop. At one loop level, I'm sure that f doesn't contribute, but I believe it doesn't contribute at any order. So. I think I finished with fixed orbifold, with the orbifolds which has at least one fixed point, and we'll go on with orbifolds like freely acting orbifolds.
So you're saying that strong coupling effect breaks almost
symmetry? For this, yes. As I understand, he asked whether the CFT is broken, the conformal property is broken for the fixed point in a strong coupling regime.
The even if you have n equal to supersymmetry?
No, that's only for non-supersymmetric case. Supersymmetry is always unbroken.
Supersymmetry, that there's no tachyon.
Right. But here there is an tachyon at the strong coupling region. Do I have 20 minutes?
At least. Yeah, 20. You need 20 more minutes?
No, I just asked.
How much time do you need?
20 minutes will be enough. More than I
need. 20 minutes, but I think this is 11 to take a break.
Okay.
Because it's not a natural break point for your talk, right?
No, not really. I just want to figure out whether I need to tell you something about you once. Do you want to make a break? Or?
Yeah, that's a
good one. Oh, sure. Ari, please turn it off.